Previously on Beta.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape.
Let's keep it short and sweet. I think you know why we're here.
Travis Scott Burger.
Hello, I'm Bob Ross. I'm certainly glad you could join me today. It's a fantastic day here, and I hope it is wherever you're at. You ready to do a fantastic little painting?
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Poet Laureate of the United States, Joy Harjo, reflects on the trials and tribulations of her life.
I had no plans to become a poet. There weren't poets in our neighborhood, or there was no table for career day that says poet, you know?
Also, musician, composer, artist, and actor John Lurie gives us the lowdown on his very creative career. Best known for forming the Lounge Lizards, Lurie has no shortage of stories, including the one time he called a legendary Canadian singer-songwriter.
And the voice on the other end goes, hello? And my mind takes a moment to kind of realize, you've just called Leonard Cohen, you idiot.
But first, T.C. Boyle. He recently released his 18th novel, Talk to Me. It's about a juvenile chimp named Sam that's learning to speak via sign language. In Talk to Me, T.C. explores provocative questions about animal consciousness, like, what if we could speak to another species in the same way that we speak to each other? What could we learn about other animals, and what could we learn about ourselves? This isn't the first time that T.C. has written about a lab chimp learning sign language. In 1979, he wrote a short story called Descent of Man about a chimpanzee named Conrad. He joins us now to share how he'd answer some of those questions, how he went about writing for another species, and why, all these years later, he wanted to revisit one of his earliest short stories.
This story was a very short, absurdist piece. The Paris Review published it, which was huge for me. I was just a kid starting out. And it was a love triangle. The first line of it is, I was living with a woman who suddenly began to stink. Well, why does she stink? This is what the reader wants to know. And she stinks because she's spending a lot of time grooming this chimp in the lab where she works. Meanwhile, she is living with a man who is a kind of a schlump, and he's kind of puzzled as to what's going on. And she is falling for the chimp, who is far more charismatic than this man. Okay, so it's a very absurdist, wild story. But I followed this subject over the many years, and now for my 29th book, I returned to it. But there is certainly humor in my portrayal of Sam, the chimp at the center of this book. Also, there's a great deal of tragedy, too, in the book. And it is not absurdist. It is sticking to what actually happened in some of these experiments. And I'm using, for my texts, the wonderful books like Nim Chimpsky by Elizabeth Hess, or Next of Kin by Roger Fouts, which is about Washoe. I was able to get all the details I needed from these and other books about these experiments, in which a chimp was raised from birth in a human household as a human child, not having any contact with its own species, so that we could gauge how language acquisition occurs and also teach the chimps to speak our language in the hope of communicating with them in a deeper way than, let's say, we communicate with our dog. You know, are you hungry? Okay, roll over. Good boy. Something that would go a little deeper. I think the hope was not necessarily a Dr. Doolittle kind of thing, but if the chimp could learn our language in the way that a 3.5-year-old child does, and this is the intelligence level of a chimp, that perhaps it could communicate something to us about the mystery of this life on this planet and who we are and why we are and what it means to be alive. But of course, the experiments began to peter out. I mean, they're still going on, but the main focus of the book and of these experiments was in the 70s and into the 80s. There are limits, of course. We didn't teach ourselves chimp language, which is a gestural language, or we did to a degree, but we couldn't communicate with them and with any depth, nor could they communicate with us with any great depth in the way that you and I are communicating right now. It just is cross species. It just doesn't work. The chimps have their own language, a gestural language. It's gotten them this far in evolution, And they would be perfectly fine if it weren't for this other great ape that came along and destroyed their environment and put them in cages and made them learn sign language.
Yeah, very well said. Some of the most compelling chapters are written from the point of view of Sam, the juvenile chimp. How did you go about channeling your inner chimpanzee to write these chapters?
I'm just projecting as I would with any character to inhabit anybody, anytime, anywhere, and make it credible. So there is always a trick to it, but it's the same trick as there is to any fiction. The reader has to enter it and believe that this is credible and see the point of view. That's the beauty of fiction, to create different points of view so that everyone can experience something outside of him or herself. And so in this case, I was doing the same thing. But you'll see that the words that I emphasize are capitalized in the text. These are the words that he knows very well. And this is how he is trying to adjust to this world. But meanwhile, the narrator stands back and says, well, this is a term he didn't know, but he wanted to know it. And we get his emotions and we also get his perspective. It was a challenge and it was a delight for me to write these chapters.
Yeah, and they're a delight, although that's kind of the wrong word to use because they portray so much of the harrowing backstory of Sam.
It does. It is. The tragedy of these experiments was that the chimp, which can live to be 50 years old, and again, is as smart as a human child of 3.5 years old. And by the way, we have a 2-year-old running around this house learning language, and it is frightening how smart he is. So you can imagine. Then these animals, once they become adolescents, have to be removed. All the chimps you see in TV and movies and so on, they're all juveniles because a chimp has twice the power of any human being, and it is a dangerous wild animal. We forget, we anthropomorphize them, but in fact, our dogs and cats, think about it, they've been bred for thousands of generations, and mostly the bad actors have been eliminated genetically. But with the chimps, they are wild animals straight out of the jungle. Now, of course, they're coming from a breeding lab, but their parents came straight out of the jungle. They have not been acculturated to human beings. They're powerful. They're angry. They have their own point of view. They don't want to be in a cage. They don't want to be taught sign language all day long.
No, of course not. You raised so many questions about animal consciousness and talked to me, and I'd like to ask you about a few of them. First up, I'd like to ask you, do you believe that animals are self-aware?
I don't think so. I don't think that they're self-aware in the way that we are, where we can name ourselves. As we talked earlier in this conversation, we have language, we can name ourselves, we can look at the past, we can look at history, we can look into the future. Certainly they are engines of their minds and their instincts. I don't know if they're exactly the machines that philosophers have made them out to be. They certainly have free agency, but I don't think they can foresee consequences of an act in the way that we can. On the other hand, I see that a lot of our behavior is mandated by our animal being. We think that we have free will and make free choices, but one could argue that it's all pre-programmed, just as it's programmed in the spring for the birds to come back to Wisconsin and find a mate and build a nest. Well, we do the same thing. We try to deny it, but I think it is true. So much of what we are is controlled hormonally. And also, we are built to reproduce the species. That's what life is. The only purpose of life is to make more life. And we can rationalize it all we want, but a large part of what we are seems to be rather mechanistic too.
This is a hypothetical question, so I don't know how you'll feel about answering it. I guess we'll find out now. If and when we are able to really communicate with animals on a more advanced level, what kinds of questions would you be most interested in asking them?
I think it's the very questions that biologists ask today. How do they do what they do? I think we will never get to a why. You know, we all feel so insignificant in the face of the life force and the face of the universe and just the sheer numbers of exoplanets. And obviously chances are there's a lot of life in the universe and it's going to be very diverse and the consciousnesses are going to be very diverse. I mean, just look at life on Earth, how it has evolved in thousands and thousands of countless species. Imagine if the conditions were different, if instead of an atmosphere of oxygen and CO2, the atmosphere was methane and creatures evolved to thrive in that atmosphere. What would we find? What would it be? And further, what is the value of the human consciousness? I often wonder about this. Evolution doesn't progress, it just happens. And so we all assume that we've progressed beyond the other apes to this brilliant status and so on, and that this is positive. But in fact, maybe all we needed was to survive in tribes and had enough brain power to bring down our prey and feed ourselves. Beyond that, look what we have wrought. What we have wrought is complete destruction on all the other species, and soon a suicidal destruction of ourselves. Maybe our brains are an evolutionary backwater. Mm-hmm. Maybe the chimps left alone in the jungle would be far better off than we in our towers.
Would there be a particular question that you would be most afraid of the animals asking you?
Yeah, why do you eat us?
Great answer.
I am fascinated by everything biological. I think if it weren't for math and science, I would have been perfectly happy as a field biologist. I observe closely. Mm-hmm. I love to be in nature, as I said earlier. I love to observe it. I'm living here in Santa Barbara, and we've got about an acre and a half of woods. I leave it for the animals. There's no pesticides. There's no nothing. I dug a pond for them. Everything is fine. So I can go outside here without having to go to the mountain. The mountain's right there where it's wild. But even right here, every day there's something new. There's some new creatures. New things are happening here. There are possums live here. Raccoons live here. What are they doing at night? What are they? What are their habits? This is fascinating. As far as what they're thinking, I don't know if they're thinking. I think their intelligence is focused on getting food.
Yeah. I think you're right.
And reproduce, of course.
Yes, yes. Much like Homo sapiens. Yeah, exactly.
Us, although we've put other layers on it, and I don't want to come off as a misanthrope, although maybe I am. We are quite beautiful in having devised our culture and being able to have conversations like this.
Mm. Well, yes. Definitely. And on behalf of all readers everywhere, I want to thank you for not becoming a field biologist, because we'd miss out on all your great fiction, all your great novels and short stories. So no, that I really mean that. It seems to me that with your novels, well, with your short stories too, but I want to focus on your novels. It seems to me that you're always trying to do something different in each of your novels. So assuming I'm right about that, what were you trying to do differently in Talk to Me?
Yes, I am always looking for new approaches in stories and novels. I feel that I don't want to be predictable. I mean, maybe thematically, you know what my themes are, and I'm always recycling them and rethinking them. But each book seems, and story too, seems to have its own way of wanting to be told. For instance, The Terranauts of a couple of years ago, which is about the experiments in the Arizona desert with the biosphere. Could we live in an enclosed environment that's self-replicating? In that novel, there are three narrators who alternate, and they're all first-person narrators, which is something that you don't normally see in a novel, because if you're in the mind of one first, I did this, I did that, and suddenly you're in the mind of the other. But still, it worked. It worked for me. I just never done it before. In this one, of course, I want to know about animal consciousness, and so I have Sam narrating chapters. In the previous book, Outside Looking In, I wanted to wonder about human consciousness, and particularly the issue of God. Is there God? Because so many LSD trippers felt that they'd had a religious experience, and then that raised the question of, well, is God some outside entity, or is it simply a miswiring or misfiring of the neurons? In any case, in that one of the attractions for me was to reproduce a couple of acid trips. Could I do that? You know, and it's always a little sketchy, because if somebody says, man, I had a great dream last night, let me tell you my dream. What could be more boring? Or let me tell you about my trip. And so I had to set it as a challenge for myself. If I don't, you know, I would go to sleep. I don't like genre writing because it's the same thing over and over. I want to be surprised. I want to surprise myself and I want to surprise you.
Yes, and you do that all the time. T.C. Boyle, thank you very much. It's always so much fun to talk to you. Congratulations on Talk to Me and on being the effervescent and entertaining and enlightening T.C. Boyle.
Thank you so much.
T.C. Boyle is the author of the novel Talk to Me. Find out more about T.C. and Talk to Me at WPR.org/beta.
Poetry is a language that can speak of things that we can't hear, see, or know, or sometimes even feel yet.
Coming up, Joy Harjo, Poet Laureate of the United States, on her life and her poetry. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
To imagine the spirit of poetry is much like imagining the shape and size of the knowing. It is a kind of resurrection light. It is the tall ancestor spirit who has been with me since the beginning, or a bear or a hummingbird. It is 100 horses running the land in a soft mist, or it is a woman undressing for her beloved in firelight. It is none of these things. It is more than everything. You're coming with me, poor thing. You don't know how to listen. You don't know how to speak. You don't know how to sing. I will teach you.
That's Joy Harjo reading an excerpt from her memoir, Poet Warrior. Joy is a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation and the first Indigenous person to serve as U.S. Poet Laureate. She is also only the second person to hold multiple terms as Poet Laureate. In Poet Warrior, Joy reflects on how the spiritual world influences her, how she accidentally became a poet, and how poetry led her to pursue music and dance. Beta's Steve Gotcher talked with Joy about her life and work. She tells him why she went from calling herself Girl Warrior to Poet Warrior.
That's what the writing gave me to do. I didn't plan on that at all. Because I wouldn't really call myself Poet Warrior, but if you think about what a warrior, you know, a warrior is a protector. A warrior, you know, can be a healer. A warrior can be a poet. But that device came about as I was writing this memoir, and suddenly this voice, the young woman, the girl becoming voice, starts speaking. And so it becomes, in the book, it's like a poetic structure, this voice of this, the inner voice of this young woman. And then I felt compelled, the me I am now, the older woman I am now, to give that girl, to help at least facilitate a coming of age ceremony for that young woman I was. That's how Poet Warrior came to be.
You talk a lot about your stepfather and that being somewhat of an abusive relation. And you mention him as being one of your greatest teachers. You say because of him, you learned to find yourself in the spiritual world. Tell me about that.
I've seen this in a lot of people's stories. I think whether you're a prisoner of war in the encampment of the enemy, or you're a child growing up in an abusive home, or in the middle of some kind of extremely stressful situation, you know, I'm not the only one. We construct, or these places are constructed for us in some way. We participate in them so that we can move through what might be too difficult to bear at that time.
So you're saying that you learn to find yourself in the spiritual world, help you cope with a bad situation?
Probably, but it was always there. I think from the very beginning, I admire great athletes. You know, my athleticism is not in the physical necessarily, although I do weights and dance and all that. But I guess what I should say, what calls to me, or what has always motivated me, is the spiritual realms. And I've learned that, well, the physical is also the spiritual. And I think I came to poetry for that, because poetry is not rhetoric. Poetry is a language that speaks, you know, can speak of things that we can't hear, see, or know, or sometimes even feel yet.
Why do you think it's important for people to write down their stories? You said that you see it as a way of healing.
Yes. What I have learned, what writing has taught me, is that it helps give perspective. And it's like kind of breathing it out that gives you a better context and perspective for understanding. So to write your story, like I had that, my cousin, Tiffany Harjo, who wound up in prison for driving a getaway car for this stupid little robbery of like a Quick Trip store. She was struggling, and I knew that she had quite a story, and she was in prison. I said, well, write your story. She told me it really helped her. And I said, I'll be a witness if you want a witness. And so she would write and write and send me packets full of her writing, longhand, just writing out everything that had happened to her. Telling a story or writing a story in a way is transforming it. To take it from one place, using a tool, whether it's digital for sound, you know, speaking your story, or taking a pen or pencil or a keyboard, you're in essence transforming it.
At some point, you started to look at poetry as a tool for justice. How did that happen?
I had no plans to become a poet. I mean, there weren't poets in our neighborhood, or there was no table for career day that says poet, you know. But yeah, I started writing poetry when I was a undergraduate at the University of New Mexico and a part of the Kiva Club, which was the Native Student Club. And we were very politically, socially active. We were looked around at our communities, and most of the students came from communities near the school, near the Albuquerque, not too far. And we began work to be helpful and assist. And that's when I began writing poetry. I met Leslie Silko, I think she's a wonderful poet. She's known for her novels and short stories. I met Simon Ortiz. I met Ishmael Reed around that time. So I was painting these paintings, and I started writing out of that.
So as a musician, you've released 7 albums, playing the saxophone and flutes, and also singing and doing spoken word. Your latest album is called I Pray for My Enemies. What can you tell me about this recording?
That one came out in March. It was recorded at the height of the pandemic. My co-producer, Barrett Martin, called up and says, you know, I'm up here, me and my wife are up here in Port Townsend, Washington, and if you can get up here the last week of the month, I have my setup here and we can get some bass tracks down and voice and bass tracks down, and then we'll just come to Tulsa a few months later. And so we had gotten our little camper RV. It's a really small one, but it works. Drove in the middle of the pandemic all the way up to, from Tulsa to Port Townsend. That's a long ways. Mm-hmm. And got it going. And wound up doing Fear Song, and from REM, Peter Buck came in and added that really cool guitar part there.
I release you, my beautiful and terrible fear. I release you. You were my beloved and hated twin, but now I don't know you as myself. I release you with all the pain I would know at the death of my children. You are not my blood anymore. I give you back to the soldiers who burned down my home, beheaded my children. I give you back to those who stole the food from our plates when we were starving.
He would say, bring out a poem. I said, well, I've thought about doing this one because of the times we're in, the fear poem. So we did a different arrangement of that. And then, you know, some of them were like that. Others were full-blown songs like How Love Blows Through the Trees, and which I wrote at the height of the pandemic. I was looking out. It was like March or April, and there was no traffic, nothing. It was quiet. It was a nice quiet. It was, the world had shifted in a way that was scary, but also there was a certain, the quiet. I'm still struck thinking about that quiet.
One of the poems that I found most compelling is in your book and also on the latest record is called For Calling the Spirit Back from Wandering the Earth in Its Human Feet. I found it an amazing piece of work that is quite comprehensive in a spiritual sense.
Put down that bag of potato chips, that white bread, that bottle of pop. Turn off that cell phone, computer, and remote control. Open the door, then close it behind you. Take a breath offered by friendly winds. They travel the earth gathering essences of plants to clean. Give it back with gratitude. If you sing, it will give your spirit lift to fly to the stars' ears and back.
I think of a poem as being a kind of ritual. The title opens the door, and then the first line, and by that you walk through line by line, each word, like step by step. And by the time you get to the end, and every part of the poem has a function, every line. And by the time you get to the end and you walk out the door of the poem, you're transformed.
Welcome your spirit back from its wandering. It may return in pieces, in tatters. Gather them together. They will be happy to be found after being lost for so long. Your spirit will need to sleep a while after it is bathed and given clean clothes. Now you can have a party. Invite everyone you know who loves and supports you. Keep room for those who have no place else to go. Make a giveaway. And remember, keep the speeches short. Then you must do this. Help the next person find their way through the dark.
How did that come to you?
How does any of it come to me? I follow it, you know. It's like I follow it. Yes, I try to take care of my craft. I write notes, I journal. And I tend to go in pockets, you know, if I get in a mode or something or I have something to do. Or there's something that is engaging me on different levels. But I tend to follow it and listen. But a lot of it's really listening and listening to what's there. Like one of my favorite lines in Poet Warrior is, even the monster has a story. And I think about that. I wonder, any artist, you know, we all engage with the spiritual realm, you know.
Right.
And that's where you hear things. I mean, that's where we know love. That's how we find art. That's how we find inspiration, etc. You know, it's through that kind of conversation.
Right.
So I feel like writing, for me, writing, or whether it's music or memoir or poetry, any of it is like a call and response. Mm-hmm. I put out something and then I listen and then I think, oh, okay. And then I kind of respond to that. And then I listen, oh, okay. And it goes back and forth.
You're now serving your third term as the Poet Laureate of the United States. What do you think you've accomplished during your tenure?
I think what has come about, because I am in this position, that it has helped immensely with awareness of Indigenous people in this country. That, for one, has been really important.
Have you seen a real difference in how people respond because you are the Poet Laureate?
Oh, yeah, of course. yeah, of course. I mean, it's an honorary position. And even before it, my reputation has come not from necessarily awards, because the awards I've gotten from my work have come in more recent years. I do what I love, and I've been lucky to get to do poetry, you know, in my life. And it's taken me a lot of places and so on. So in a way, with the Poet Laureate position, I'm doing what I've always done. I go into communities, I talk with people, I listen, we write poetry, listen to poetry. I've been doing that for years all over the country and around the world. And so I'm doing what I've always done, but the title, of course, you know, it certainly gives me more of a kind of place that I did not have before.
So I have one more final question for you. When events in the world happen, people always ask pundits, journalists, experts, to explain it. One time I was listening to the radio and somebody asked, what do the poets say about what's happening? And I thought that was a brilliant question. So I wonder if you have a poem that sums up your thoughts or some ideas that sums up your thoughts on the current state of the world.
where do we start? You know, do we start with global warming, tragedy, the emergence of all the social reemergence, or maybe their presence of things that my generation, we thought we had changed, and now it everything seems to be in shards, in pieces. And yet there's the children, the grandchildren. Here we are talking. We're talking about poetry on the radio. The radio has not been taken over for the state or silenced for the state, which we were headed that way in this country. You know, we keep growing and we keep learning. So I'll read this poem. It's called When the World as We Knew It Ended. And I wrote this after 9/11. It was coming. We had been watching since the eve of the missionaries in their long and solemn clothes to see what would happen. We saw it from the kitchen window over the sink as we made coffee, cooked rice and potatoes, enough for an army. We saw it all as we changed diapers and fed the babies. We saw it through the branches of the knowledgeable tree, through the snags of stars, through the sun and storms, from our knees as we bathed and washed the floors. The conference of the birds warned us as they flew over destroyers in the harbor, parked there since the first takeover. It was by their song and talk we knew when to rise, when to look out the window to the commotion going on, the magnetic field thrown off by grief. We heard it, the racket in every corner of the world as the hunger for war rose up in those who would steal to be president, to be king or emperor, to own the trees, stones, and everything else that moved about the earth, inside the earth and above it. We knew it was coming. Tasted the winds who gathered intelligence from each leaf and flower, from every mountain, sea, and desert, from every prayer and song all over this tiny universe floating in the skies of infinite being. And then it was over, this world we had grown to love for its sweet grasses, for the many colored horses and fishes, for the shimmering possibilities while dreaming. But then, there were the seeds to plant and the babies who needed milk and comforting, and someone picked up a guitar or ukulele from the rubble and began to sing about the light flutter, the kick beneath the skin of the earth we felt there beneath us, a warm animal, a song being born between the legs of her, a poem.
That's Joy Harjo reading her poem, When the World as We Knew It Ended. Joy is the Poet Laureate of the United States and the author of Poet Warrior, a memoir. She spoke with Beta's Steve Gotcher. You can find out more about Joy at wpr.org/beta.
So I created the Marvin Pontiac character so I'd have a mask to sing behind, so it would kind of free me up a little bit, give me a little bit more confidence, and, you know, to give it a character, because John Lurie sings, I just couldn't do that.
The Lounge Lizard himself, John Lurie, joins us in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. John Lurie had a huge impact on the world of art and culture in downtown New York during the 1980s and beyond. As a musician, composer, artist, and actor, John followed his ambitions and relentless imagination to make things happen. And he did it his way, as he explains in his memoir, The History of Bones. John co-founded the legendary band The Lounge Lizards. He acted in such pivotal films as Stranger Than Paradise and Down by Law, which led to The New Yorker calling John the Humphrey Bogart of the 80s. I believe this means that Humphrey Bogart is the John Lurie of the 40s. John's HBO show, Painting with John, proves that he remains a creative force. In his memoir, he admits that he never would have said this out loud to anyone, but his life goal was to find and express God through music.
I don't know how to talk about that kind of thing. One, when you mention God, it's like that means a million different things to a million different people. And this is something I could really only express through music, and to talk about it seems to cheapen it or make it something that it really isn't. So I'm hesitant to go there. You know, if I was Rumi or Ieyasu, I might attempt to do it, but I'm not. So let's just, I'm shy to go there. Do you know what I mean? Fair enough, right?
Yeah, oh, I know exactly what you mean. It is, you're right. God means different, so many different things to so many different people. It's a tough one to answer. So yeah.
but you could keep, don't edit that out. But I mean, I don't know how to answer.
Right, fair enough. You and your younger brother, Evan, co-founded the Lounge Lizards in 1979. What was your objective with the Lounge Lizards? What were you trying to achieve?
Oh, it was a time of no objectives. Evan had just moved to New York. I'd been in a band in high school with Steve Piccolo. Ardo Lindsay and I were jamming a bunch with different people, and Ardo luckily brought in Anton Fear, who sort of whipped us into shape in rehearsal where we were all just fooling around. And I was writing music for a movie that I wanted to make called Fatty Walks. But so I had this music that I'd written, and then it just happened by such accident. Jim Farrad asked, which was a good band to play on a Monday night opening for Peter Gordon. And I said, oh, my band, not having a band. And we rehearsed twice and came together on stage.
The legendary rock critic Lester Bangs wrote that the Lounge Lizards were, quote, staking out new territory that lies somewhere west of Charles Mingus and east of Bernard Herrmann.
Isn't that a nice thing? I mean, with all the crappy journalists writing horrible things about us, and Lester was one of the few art critics and music critics that I actually respected, and then to pick two of my complete heroes, that was a nice moment when he did that. That was really nice, because we were being written off as a bunch of phonies, you know, and then Lester stepped in and said that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, you couldn't ask for a nicer description. Do you think it was accurate?
No, you can't ask me that. That's like...
Okay.
But yes, I do. But
yeah. In 1986, the Lounge Lizards recorded a live album in Tokyo. And you say that walking back to the hotel, listening to the recording of the song Big Heart, cranked up in your headphones, was one of the happiest moments of your life.
Yes.
Why?
Well, one, you know, when I don't often do that walk around listening to music with headphones. But when you do, the place becomes modified. You can walk down the street in wherever. In New York City, you walk down the street listening to Umu Sangara. I had this experience once, and she changed what New York City was. And the song Big Heart did that. So Tokyo is quite, you know, is visually quite fascinating anyways, with you know, especially during a bustling time. And kind of also the kind of ancient and modern stuff mixed together, and some guy unloading fish from a cart, and then the neon lights going off. But the sound of the song overwhelmed the visual experience, and it sounded good. It was also partly just because it sounded good.
One of our favorite Lounge Lizards compositions is the title track from the Voice of Chunk album, which was released in 1988. Can you tell us a bit about this song?
One, that chuck-a-chuck-chuck-a-chuck. I was in that movie, Last Temptation of Christ, and while I was in Morocco making that movie, I spent a lot of time with the Ganawa musicians, and they're mostly like outside of town in this little encampment. And I guess they don't really live anywhere, they're gypsies, but they're really just music that just moved me really deeply. And that, so that beginning thing, that rhythm is based on that. Chuck, 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 chuck. And then it's just that call and response between the two saxophones is a nice thing, but that doesn't sound Ganawa-ish. And then Revo takes his solo, that's phenomenal. But he, every night, I mean, you know, night after night, he would take these amazing solos on that.
You say that what you might have been best at in your life was doing film scores for movies. Do mm-hmm. you have a favorite film score that you composed that you're most proud of?
I mean, the two I'm kind of most proud of were the Variety score for Betty Gordon and the Manny and Lowe for Lisa Krueger. And those were just, partly I was proud of those because they were done for $0, you know. And the musicians also kind of, everybody really liked Lisa Krueger, so they all came and played for next to nothing and went and did that music, and it came out really good. And the same with the Betty Gordon thing. It was like I hired musicians off the street and gave them like $75 each for the afternoon. Some really good players, and you know, you just did them in a day or a day and a half, you know, with no money and no producers leaning over you and ruining it, you know.
You've also done a lot of acting. You appeared in Jim Jarmusch's Stranger Than Paradise and Down by Law, also Wim Wenders' Paris, Texas, and Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ. Has acting influenced your music and your art in any way?
I don't see that. The acting was kind of a side thing for me.
You were good at it, though, and you got a lot of acclaim for your acting.
I had moments. I mean, I think there's an honesty in me that kind of comes through. But I didn't really have any chops as an actor, you know? I didn't mm-hmm. really have... And if I worked on it more, I think I might have been good. But I was much more concentrating on music. I mean, you learn something from everything. You know, from the rhythm of things you learn. But I can't think of a specific way that acting informed the music, really.
Yeah. One of your latest projects is the HBO series Painting with John, written, mm-hmm. directed, and starring you.
It's important to have fun every day. Roll a tire down a hill. Bounce. Roll two tires down a hill. Bounce. Every day. A little bit of fun. That's what I think.
What do you get out of doing the show? And what do you want your viewers to get out of watching you?
We were going to just make these two-minute things to cheer people up a bit. People just seem so depressed. And we were going to just make these two-minute vignettes of Nezrin, my assistant, and I teasing each other while I painted. Because they were cute. They were funny. And Eric Marcus came down to film it with us, but we were just going to put them on Instagram and on our website and stuff. And Eric was so good at this stuff, and we enjoyed working together, so they just started. So basically what I wanted first was to just cheer people up. That was the original motivation behind it.
Does doing the show, does it cheer you up?
Well, yes and no. I mean... I'm going in a couple of days, I'm going to Montreal to work with Eric, but right now he's just emailing me stuff. So mm-hmm. we did this one thing. This is Anne-Marie James is the woman who, you know, she shops and cooks for me down there. And mm-hmm. she had overcooked these potatoes so that they were hard as a rock. And I said, Anne-Marie, these will only be good as a weapon. And then and then for a couple of years, I would tease her about Anne-Marie's weapon potatoes. So then we filmed a scene with her as though she was running a cooking show, but this is how you make weapon potatoes. And she would carve a spearhead out of the potatoes and overcook them, and she would explain overcooking them. And then Eric attached them to these long sticks that we bought from the hardware store. And then we went out and Nezrin announces, now we will invade neighboring villages. And then me and Eric wrote this song where we sing Anne-Marie Glud James, her weapon potatoes are the sharpest in the land. So we're singing this very catchy melody without us marching down the street with our weapon potato sticks and silly hats. And so to see that, it's just me, Nezrin, and Anne-Marie, which is really my house, you know, and it just warms your heart beyond belief. And It's hard to tell if other people will be as moved by it as we were, but it certainly moved me.
Oh, that's great, yeah. You've been dealing with Lyme disease and cancer for some time now. How are you feeling these days?
The cancer is done. The cancer is, there's no evidence of cancer left. The side effects from the treatment left me with a bunch of stuff that still sort of lingers. The Lyme disease is just the weirdest, and you just don't know what is being caused by that and what isn't, you know, and it causes all kinds of fluctuations in your blood pressure, your thyroid, your all kinds of metabolic. So you can be going along, you know, and you're fine, and then suddenly you're completely woozy or you've got all this nerve pain or, you know, but it's much, much less than what it was. In fact, I used to 10 years ago, 15 years ago, assume I was going to be sick for the day. And now I assume I'm going to be well, but then I get hit with this wall of problems, you know. So, but I'm okay. I'm functioning. Plus, yeah, if you read the book, I'm 68 years old, and the most frequently asked question was, how the blank is this guy still alive? So I've kind of done a lot of stuff to the body that, you know, I'm lucky to be here at all. So I won't complain.
Yeah, yeah. A while back, you created this alter ego named Marvin Pontiac and recorded an album as Marvin Pontiac. Why did you want to do this?
I did two records with Marvin Pontiac.
Oh, two records. Okay, I'm sorry.
Well, the second one seems to have gone by the boards without people being aware of it. The Asylum one, which I did in 2017, which I'm quite proud of. And I did it all myself, all me on guitar and harmonica and vocals. And I think it's really good, and nobody seems to know about it. So so you should play a cut from it. Feel like hollering. Hey, I feel like hollering. I feel like hollering. Hey, I feel like hollering. How it started being Marvin Pontiac was, I had all this music, like from the Not Quite Right for the Lounges. It was a Right for a Film score, and it needed vocals. And I had sort of accumulated all this music over the years, and then I added the vocals. But at the beginning, I really couldn't sing, and it was kind of embarrassing. So I had to create a character. So I created the Marvin Pontiac character, so I'd have a mask to sing behind, so it would kind of free me up a little bit, give me a little bit more confidence, and, you know, to give it a character, because John Lurie sings, I just couldn't do that. So that's how Marvin Pontiac, that's how it got started. And then it was really, but then I started getting quotes from, you know, I got one from Flea, who's my good friend, and from Angelique Kijo, who's on the record, and then, so I got one from Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
But the best thing that happened was that Bob Dylan said he didn't give quotes. And I needed somebody from that kind of demographic, you know, to say Marvin Pontiac was a big influence on me or something. Mm. And I remembered that Barb, my travel agent, was Leonard Cohen's travel agent. Barb, do you mind giving me Leonard Cohen's phone number? And she said, I'm not comfortable with that. And I said, that's fine. I wouldn't want you to get out my phone number, so I appreciate that. An hour later, Barb, the travel agent, calls me and says, okay, here's the number. And I dial the number, and the voice on the other end goes, hello? and my mind takes a moment to kind of realize, you've just called Leonard Cohen, you idiot. And I'm not prepared to talk to Leonard Cohen. I didn't have my spiel ready, you know. And then he goes, "Hello," and then I did what you're doing. I started to laugh. So then I had to hang up on Leonard Cohen, which I, you know, and I waited like 3 days before I called him back and explained what I wanted. Hello.
And you were able that the 3 days later, you were able to talk to him without laughing, eh?
Yeah, well, I didn't fess up to it. I didn't, yeah.
I see. Well, yeah, that's a great story, yeah. John Lurie, thank you so much for joining us today. Congratulations on The History of Bones, Painting with John, all of the great music that the Lounge Lizards produced, and all of your other great accomplishments, including being the Greg Popovich of music, which allows Greg Popovich to be the John Lurie of basketball. Think about that one. Okay. It was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, man, and thanks for reading the book.
That was John Lurie. He's a founding member of the legendary Lounge Lizards and the author of the memoir, The History of Bones. Find out much more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, T.C. Boyle, Joy Harjo, and John Lurie. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, Beta is now available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Now, I know you got into some trouble before you came here, but since then you've become one of the top people I've got working in this program.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Now, don't take it personally if he doesn't like you right away. He will.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I would just like to thank you for this opportunity, and I hope that I can be of some real benefit to the program.